Veterans salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of COTA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use COTA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on COTA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
Blissful, and that was the 60s.
Always party time.
Dennis really liked women. Dennis appears to have liked women pretty much indiscriminately.
You know, initially for Dennis Wilson, it was great. It was girls, drugs, and Manson could supply both.
So that you could pick it up any second and shoot.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners, the unintentional deep dive of the Manson family. So last week, with the help of host of That So Fucked Up podcast, Ashley, we dove into Leslie Van Houten's story. But on my radar, before even connecting with Ashley, I had intended to eventually cover the story of perhaps the most devoted of all Manson's followers, at least in terms of longevity. And her life story is tragically fascinating. She is a complex person, both parts sweet and sinister. But if we look back at her past, we might see how Squeaky ended up in the throes of Charles Manson, a man she can't quite seem to shake. This is the story of a California girl, born in an era that was set up for the risk of a girl falling in to the likes of a Charles Manson type, but also a story that started far before that chance meeting. It's a story of the time of counterculture and the residual effects of generational trauma. And it's a story of a life that is incredibly hard to wrap your head around. This is the story of Lynette Squeaky Fromm. Yet the twists and turns of her life would include being the number two girl in the Manson family, an attempted assassination of a president, witnessing a murder, and now a seemingly normal housewife life. Lynette Squeaky Fromm was born in Santa Monica, California on October 22nd, 1948, to parents Helen and William Fromm. And I might be saying her name wrong. It might be Frommy. I've heard it different ways, but I'm going to go with Fromm. But for the rest of the episode, we're going to call her Squeaky because it's easier. But her mom was a housemaker and her dad was an aeronautical engineer. He was a guarded man and their household was said to be cold. Her parents didn't have a great relationship, but managed to stay married during Lynette's childhood. But the coldness of that household will come back into play in a moment and could have been one of the catalysts for Squeaky's troubles. But Squeaky's childhood wasn't all terrible. She was adorable, almost childlike looking. Even in early adulthood, she maintained those same physical characteristics. Her classmates initially described her as shy, but dance is what really got her out of her shell. And she was talented. As a child, she performed with a popular dance group called the Westchester Lariats, which began touring the United States and Europe in the late 1950s. And she even appeared dancing at the White House. By the time Squeaky was in high school, the family had moved to Redondo Beach, where Squeaky attended Redondo Union High, which was a mix of a few high points, but those were outnumbered by very low points. One high point is that her classmates voted her personality plus. She dated, even being in a relationship at one point with Bill Siddons, who would later go on to manage the Doors. Squeaky's brush with fame wouldn't just end with Bill Siddons, though. Squeaky, who had a years-long correspondence with CBS reporter Paul LaRosa, who eventually wrote up snippets of their exchanges in an article called exclusive My Private Letters from Squeaky Fromm, revealed in a biography about her, and the letters exchanged between her and Paula Rosa regarding her childhood friendship with SNL actor and comedian Phil Hartman, who bizarrely was also murdered. He was murdered by his wife. Squeaky writes to Paula Rosa, "I had asked her about the murder of comedian Phil Hartman." That's him saying that. Because I knew from reading her biography that former Saturday Night Live comic and Lynette went to the same high school and were close friends. Yes, the truth is stranger than fiction. I agree, dude. Hartman had been murdered, shot to death by his wife, who then killed herself. Lynette had a real fondness for Hartman. She wrote back and said, "I wonder if he had any notion that such was possible, or did he not believe her, or did she not say?" Lynette said that she had read reports of the murder-suicide in the National Enquirer and the Star and did not believe the level of detail they provided. She said, quote, "I have somewhere in my junior high school yearbooks with Phil's writings and a little cartoon surfer he drew. I think he was funnier in high school than on TV, although some of what I saw on SNL of him was excellent. We took drama together for 18 months or 2 years, and we had fun. He was more supportive than competitive, and so enthusiastic that it was fun to go to class with him and anyone like him." But not all of Squeaky's memories from high school were positive ones. She began acting out and attention-seeking in high school, and was clearly in emotional pain. According to the biography documentary, The Manson Women, The Family That Kills Together, this became evident when an after-school job, her friends remembered her grabbing a staple gun and methodically stapling her arm in front of them without flinching. When she was in high school, her father suddenly stopped talking to her for 3 years while living under the same roof. He literally would not speak to her. If she had something to say, she would have to speak to her mom, who would then relay it to her dad. And she really had no idea why this was happening. But it must have felt like he was giving up on her. She also began using alcohol and drugs at that time, and her grades dropped at Redondo High, but she did graduate in 1966, and she moved out of her parents' house for a few months before. Eventually, I guess her father was talking to her again because he convinced her to enroll at El Camino College. She then returned home for 2 months before her father kicked her out again following an argument. And then she was left homeless. At 19, Squeaky was homeless, just mere miles from where she grew up. Abandoned by her parents, alone, a chance meeting, and the first offer of someone to take her in came in the form of Charles Manson. This was 1967. Charles Manson was 32, and Squeaky, just 19. But Charles Manson pinpointed and was predatory towards girls and women that were struggling for whatever reason. And Charles knew how to spot them. So when he saw Squeaky sitting on the beach in Venice, California, reading a book, a van pulled up, and a man got out, and he walked straight up to her and said, "Your parents threw you out, didn't they?" She must have thought this was some sort of sign. In the biography documentary, The Manson Women, they air an interview she did back in 1994 where she describes the encounter like this.
He waited for, 30 seconds or so, and he said, I can't make up your mind for you. And he said goodbye and he left. He got about halfway down the block, and I just grabbed everything and I ran.
She became already addicted to him in that moment, and she would remain addicted to him for the rest of her life, it seems. This is a clip from Squeaky from ABC's documentary series 1969. It aired in 2019, 50 years after the infamous and heartbreaking Tate LaBianca murders, where Squeaky is still stating 50 years later her devotion to him. and she may also just be devoted to the mindset at the time. I'll let you decide. And I'm going to stop in between the clip to explain the visual.
My name is Lynette Fromey. Was I in love with Charlie? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, still am. Still am. I don't think you fall out of love. My father and I, we argued one night. He said, get out and don't ever come back. And I hitchhiked to a place in Venice where there used to be beatniks. I thought maybe somebody would take me in. It was dark and nobody was there. And I was sitting just looking at the ocean, and here comes Charlie. He scared me at first. He was attractive in ways and yet not attractive in other ways. When he offered me a place, I didn't know what to say. I was afraid to go. But he said, I can't make up your mind for you. That's why I went with him. And he never did make up my mind for me. These stories that have come out about his ordering people to do things, never ordered me.
They must be asking her about the murder of Sharon Tate, because a photo of her flashes on the screen in the documentary. And Squeaky's response seems that she was devoted to some cause, whether it be Charles Manson or the movement at the time, because there is a lack of empathy that's hard to wrap my head around.
Well, believe me, you know, at the time, it was just one more person who was being killed. I'm telling you, when the war is very visible and conflict in the streets is visible, I determined not to make judgments.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Moro Casino. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th, and every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at coda.com/trip planner.
There is no excuse for her callousness, but we also have to remember that she was damaged. She saw Charlie as a father figure, and she was on copious amounts of LSD at the time, was coerced and controlled. He knew all of the girls that followed him were damaged from damaged homes, that they were lost. Squeaky would be the second member to join Manson's cult. The first being a Berkeley librarian named Mary Bruner. So off Squeaky goes in the van with Manson and Mary for the first of several wild rides of her life. By 1968, Charles Manson's cult family had grown to about 25 people. And this was about the time that they met Beach Boy Dennis Wilson. Now, there are differing accounts as to how this happened, but it seems that Manson and Wilson had briefly met previously. But then, when Wilson unknowingly picked up two of Charles Manson's girls, it would reconnect Manson and Wilson and set off a series of events that would change and break so many lives. According to LouderSound.com and documentaries I mentioned earlier, the introduction goes somewhat like this. Beach Boys co-founder Dennis Wilson first came into contact with Manson earlier that same year, following a chain of events which began with the musician giving a ride to two hitchhikers. The two travelers, Patricia Cronwinkle and Ella Jo Bailey, turned out to be followers of Manson, and enchanted by their conversations on spirituality and their shared interests in transcendental meditation, Wilson invited the pair to visit his home. Sometime later, after work commitments had taken him away from Los Angeles, he returned home to discover that the girls were now living there, along with their guru, Manson, who would come to affectionately be referred to as the Wizard. Dennis seemed to want to help out Charlie, and Charlie was supplying him with women. And it seemed Dennis genuinely liked Charles Manson's music, so much so that he introduced him to producer Terry Mulcher, son of Doris Day, but a man that was far more savvy in discerning who shouldn't be trusted. Coming from a family and upbringing where people want something from you, and not always with the best of intentions, Terry kept Charlie at arm's length. But Dennis seemed more naive or less guarded. While Charles Manson and his girls were living at Dennis Wilson's house, Mike Love, co-founder of the Beach Boys, came forward later with this chilling story. It was the first major red flag for him. Here's a clip from ABC's 2020 doc, The Family Manson.
We were invited by Dennis to come to dinner to meet Charlie and the family. There were in a group sex kind of situation, and it wasn't my cup of tea. So I excused myself to take a shower. No sooner than I got in the shower, door opened, and Charlie Manson stood there and looked up at me and said, "You can't do that." I said, "Excuse me? You can't leave the group." And he looked at me with these wide eyes and kind of maniacal look. "One of your group members is involved with something so weird." It was kind of frightening and freaky to me.
But Dennis was so entranced by Charlie and liked his music, vibed with it more than the all-American clean image of the current Beach Boys songs, that he took a song of Charlie's here.
Cease to exist, just come and say you love me. Give up your world, come on, you can't be. I'm your kind, oh, your kind, I can see. Walk on, walk on, I love you, pretty girl. My life is yours, yeah, you can have my world. Never had a lesson I ever learned, but I know we all get our turn. I love you.
Dennis changed a few lyrics and the title and brought it to the Beach Boys. None of the other members had any idea of the origins of that song, and they actually sang it live on the Mike Douglas Show. This is the incident we spoke about last week that caused Charles Manson to deliver a bullet, a warning to Dennis Wilson that he was on his hit list. But before the Songgate of 68 that set Charlie off, they were all living at Dennis Wilson's house. The Manson family was not a huge cult at its height. It had about 30 members, but they were staying at his house. But between the trouble that they caused with noise complaints and the drug money it cost Dennis Wilson, within a few months of knowing Charlie, Dennis had spent $100,000 on the family. You know, Dennis may have liked chicks and drugs, but it wasn't worth Charlie and the cost of his family. And with the stealing of the song in Charlie's mind and the kicking them out and being shunned by Terry Mulcher, Charlie was out for revenge, which helped spur the grisly events that changed everything. But before things hit their tipping point, the family moved to a place called Spawn Ranch, an old Western movie set owned by a man named George Spawn, an isolated aging movie set that was once the production site of wholesome shows like Bonanza and The Lone Ranger. George Spawn was a blind, lonely, 81-year-old man who seemed to like Charles Manson and the company of he and his followers. According to a 1970 article in Esquire magazine titled "Charles Manson's Home on the Range, No Deer, No Antelope, But Strange Sounds for a Blind Man's Ear" by Gay Talese, Talese reported that Spawn liked Manson and Manson would visit his shack on quiet afternoons and talk for hours about deep philosophical questions that bewildered the old man but interested him, relieving the loneliness. Then Claudia Verhoeven, an associate professor at Cornell, who teaches a class on Manson, says the family helped out on the ranch, cleaning, cooking, making repairs, and taking care of the horses, including renting them out to tourists. Many have assumed that the girls lived there in exchange for sex with Spawn, especially Squeaky, who spent the most time with him. But that has been contested, even by Squeaky herself, and it seems that Squeaky is not one to hold back on experiences in her life. According to Squeaky, George reminded her of her grandfather, who she never got to spend much time with. And perhaps these were playful grabs, not sexual, but we will truly never know. But George Spawn is the one that gave Squeaky her nickname, based on the noises she would make whenever he grabbed her. But it wasn't all friendship and service on the ranch. Well, I guess there was plenty of service, and that was to Charles Manson. Anything at his command. There was group sex. All of the women slept with Charlie and whoever he commanded them to sleep with. This, to Squeaky at least, though, was the most family she'd ever had. Charles Manson, the biggest, albeit twisted, father figure she'd ever had. And her former Manson sisters also seemed to remember her as motherly. That was her role. According to interviews with former members in the biography doc I mentioned earlier, they say this.
She was very supportive to all of us. People in the family, she was a little bit maternal in how I related to her. She was a very nice, loving person. You'd never know.
But soon the Spawn Ranch would become infamous for the headquarters of the Manson family, the place where they were ordered to do many bizarre things, like creepy crawlies, which basically would be that Charlie would order them to go out at night and break into houses, sometimes not even to steal anything, but just to rearrange things inside the house, intentionally instilling fear and intimidation and, frankly, confusion in local residents. And remember, they were also constantly on LSD, which I know we discussed in the last episode, but I want to make a point of the chaos and control everyone was under. And this is where the reenacting of the crucifixion would often come in. Hi, these girls would watch Charles Manson reenact it. When Charles Manson is interviewed about it, he also unapologetically and maniacally responds like this.
You had them thinking you were Jesus Christ. How did you do that?
Just being myself. All men are Jesus Christ.
They are?
Sure.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans Ride Free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans Ride Free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.
What's sad and hard to watch is most of the women interviewed in this documentary seem to self-reflect that this was a terrible time. But Squeaky, on the other hand, says with glee that she wanted to be like him, wanted to be him. And perhaps that's why, while she wasn't present for the Tate-LaBianca murders, she went on to worship and rally around Charles Manson, and then go on to commit stranger acts of violence.
Did you want to be like him?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did all of you want to be like him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. People who met him wanted to be like him. Men, especially, wanted to have that kind of charisma. So they would do the things that he did, but they didn't do them with the same spirit.
Now, here's the thing. I wasn't going to talk about the horrific murders because they are so heartbreaking. But now I feel like I'm highlighting some of the Manson women and not discussing what the group did. So there will be a part 3 and deep dive on the Manson murders next week. And I'd be willing to bet that most people only know of the Tate-LaBianca murders, but there are more murders connected to the Manson family. So I think that deserves an entire episode. Frankly, the victims and their lives deserve more than that, but it's too intricate and heartbreaking not to honor the victims, tell their stories, and show the very dark side of the Manson family. So that will be next week, but we're going to go back to Squeaky because my aim was always to do a biopic. I don't know if that's how you say it. I actually wrote my notes, ask Greg what the word would be on... Greg, what would you call it? It's not like a biopic because you can't see it. What would
a biopod.
Oh. Yeah. You're a cult leader. You just came up with your own word. Biopod. So for now, my aim was to do a biopod on Squeaky and the strange twists and turns of her life. But this case is so big, it's very easy to go down another rabbit hole. And I'm just trying to stay on Squeaky for this one because Squeaky tries to assassinate a president. So let's get back on it. So, the summer of 1969 is a summer that the murders took place. And for those murders, Susan Atkins, Patricia Cronwinkel, Leslie Van Houten, Charles Manson, and Tex Watson, one of the only male followers, were the ones to stand trial. Squeaky was not present for these murders, and some speculate that perhaps Manson didn't think she had it in her to do it. But was always devoted. She defended the family. Initially, the women on trial were all still entranced by Manson as well. They would chant in the courtroom, giggle in the hallways. They seemed incredibly detached. It was very scary. And Squeaky was the one to lead the charge on the outside, organizing and keeping everyone in Charles Manson's command. I have a family member, actually, who told me of driving past the courthouse while that trial was happening and seeing the Manson girls outside with the carvings on their foreheads. I mean, it changed them just to see it. This show of devotion of the girls in the court chanting for Charlie and the girls outside lasted for 10 months, with Squeaky being the mouthpiece for the press. It was a truly terrifying time, and I can't even imagine what the poor victims' families were feeling. The girls who killed at Charles Manson's command were also instructed by Charlie at sentencing to take the load and take death so he could be released and continue his works to save the world. And when Leslie, Susan, and Patricia took the stand, they did just that. Still, all three of them, including Charlie, were sentenced to death, and those young women were the youngest women in California history to be sentenced to death. they were sentenced to the gas chamber at San Quentin. They spent 10 months on death row before the Supreme Court ruled the death penalty unconstitutional and their sentences lowered to life in prison. But the girls in prison were slowly becoming wise to Charlie's con, and their devotion was fading. But Squeaky's was not. The 22-year-old tried to unite the last few members of Manson's family to stay together, but it was a futile mission. And then Squeaky's life took many different, strange turns that led to the incident that landed her in prison. In 1972, shortly after Charlie and the girls were sentenced, Squeaky traveled to Stockton with the Aryan Brotherhood in order to follow through with Manson's deal with the Brotherhood. Charlie wanted protection in jail after he was found guilty of the Tate-LaBianca murders and agreed to loan his women out to the Aryan Brotherhood as comfort aides. Who knows if that's exactly why she was there? A lot of it doesn't make sense. But Squeaky was also present in 1972 when two Manson affiliates from the Aryan Brotherhood forced a man to dig his own grave before killing and burying him in Stockton, California. The story goes like this. Squeaky travels to Stockton. She's with Nancy Pittman, Priscilla Cooper, and Aryan Brotherhood members Michael Montfort and James Craig. The group met with James and Lauren Willett at a cabin. In November of 1972, the two Aryan brothers forced James Willett to dig his own grave and then shot him because he was going to tell the authorities about a series of robberies that they had committed after they were released from prison. His body was found with his hand still sticking out of the ground. The housemates were arrested on suspicion of murder, after which Lauren's body was discovered in the basement. She had been shot to death. Their 8-month-old daughter, Heidi, was found alive in the house. Now, Squeaky was released for lack of evidence. Perhaps she witnessed it. Maybe she didn't. But the way they found her is that she telephoned the house while she knew the police were there raiding the house, asking to be picked up, and the officers obliged, taking her into custody nearby. Police found a quantity of guns in the house, ammunition, marijuana, whatever. But she at least was near that, but she was released for lack of evidence. After leaving Stockton, Squeaky moved to Sacramento with a woman named Sandra Good. The two wore robes on occasion and changed their names to symbolize their devotion to Manson's new religion. Squeaky becoming Red in honor of her red hair and the California redwoods, and Good becoming Blue for her blue eyes and the ocean. And both nicknames were originally given to them by Manson. So, Squeaky's having a rough go. On the outside, she seemed to feel guilty that the girls were on the inside. Squeaky felt like she'd lost the only family she'd ever had, that they were behind bars, and that she was the only one that could carry on Charlie's mission. So, in letters, the girls challenged Squeaky and said, "If you still really believe in Charlie, and you're not serving time like we are, what have you done lately to prove that?" Well, on September 5th, 1975, she strapped a gun to her leg and showed up at an appearance of President Gerald Ford in Sacramento's Capitol Park. Her goal? To show devotion to Manson and to the redwood trees. Dressed in a robe and armed with a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol, she pointed a gun at the president, but was immediately restrained by Secret Service. When cameras were rolling during her arrest, she said it didn't go off. The pistol's magazine was loaded with 4 rounds, but there were no bullets in the chamber. In 1980, Squeaky told the Sacramento Bee that she had deliberately ejected the round from her weapons chamber before leaving home that morning, and investigators later found a round on her bathroom floor. She claims she never intended to shoot the president. Essentially, she just wanted to force him into a light conversation about trees and relay a message from Charles Manson.
Ford had his hands out and was waving. He looked like cardboard to me. I got 2 feet from him. I could have shot twice had I put the bullet in there.
Her only goal, she said, was to relay a message from Manson.
I said, Your Honor, the redwood trees need to be saved. They're the tallest trees in the world, and if you can't save your world's tallest trees, something's wrong.
Squeaky refused to cooperate with her own defense during her trial. Despite claiming that I was not determined to kill the guy, she was eventually convicted of the attempted assassination of the president and received a life sentence under 1965 law that made attempted presidential assassinations a federal crime. Attorney Duane Keyes recommended severe punishment because she was full of hate and violence. And she threw an apple at him, hitting him in the face and knocking off his glasses. She told the press that she came to get life, not just my life, but clean air, healthy water, and respect for creatures and creation. Okay. I think LSD is a hell of a drug, I'm guessing. It stays with you. I also think there might be some unchecked mental illness and cult mind control. And I think she's lost with extreme trauma. I'm just trying to make sense of it. That's just my opinion. I don't know. I blame the LSD and Charles Manson. But she doesn't stop there. In 1979, Squeaky was transferred out of federal prison after attacking a fellow inmate with a hammer. Then on December 23rd, 1987, she escaped a federal prison camp in West Virginia in an attempt to meet Manson. She was captured 2 days later and incarcerated in Texas. And she continued to profess total allegiance to Manson. She once told the AP, "The curtain is going to come down on all of us, and if we don't turn everything over to Charlie immediately, it will be too late." She first became eligible for parole in 2005, and she was granted parole in July of 2008, but was not released because of extra time added for the 1987 prison escape. She was eventually released on parole in 2009. And as of 2019 reporting, she now lives a somewhat suburban life with her boyfriend in a house decorated with skulls. And she still professes her love for Charles Manson. And we'll end on another clip of her and a clip of Charles Manson, who he himself, till the day he died, showed zero remorse. Thank you guys so much for listening. And if you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star rating and positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. I love you. Bye.
I feel very honored to have met him. And I know how that sounds to people who think he's the epitome of evil.
You have beat me, knocked my teeth out, broke my neck, drugged me with drugs, dragged me up and down hallways, prison hallways, handcuffed.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
CODA salutes those who served. Veterans ride free Tuesday, November 11th. And every other day of the year, our veterans and active duty military personnel get a 50% discount on all fares. It's all part of CODA's ongoing commitment to show appreciation for your selfless service. To ride at no cost on fixed routes, tell your bus operator that you're a veteran or use code VET2025 in the app to use CODA Plus. Veterans ride free on Tuesday, November 11th for Veterans Day. Veterans get a 50% discount every day on CODA. Plan your ride and learn more at CODA.com/trip planner.